cannot identify asymptomatic individuals. Tracing is also compromised if it's not feasible to quarantine those individuals whom we find, either because they are unwilling or unable to self-isolate at home, or because we lack places where they can stay, for example, if they are homeless or if they live in a crowded environment. It's only when you can test, trace, and isolate that you can break the chains of transmission and bring a virus under control. When the number of cases gets too large, however, either because containment has failed or because of the nature of the pathogen itself, as happened in many parts of the country by late March, contact tracing is no longer possible at the scale that is needed. At that point, widespread implementation of physical distancing is necessary in order to slow the epidemic and reduce the number of cases so that contact tracing might once again be realistic. One of the reasons the South Koreans were able to avoid employing more stringent physical distancing measures is that they rapidly deployed extraordinary testing and tracing procedures along with universal mask adoption. If testing, tracing, and isolating fail to stop the spread of the pathogen, what can be done? For this objective, we must decrease social mixing using physical distancing measures. The fewer people that the average person comes into contact with each day, the better. And school closures have historically been one of the most effective ways to interrupt transmission chains. By the end of March 2020, 94% of American schools had been shuttered, most of them for the duration of the school year. This reduced social mixing among the nation's 56.6 million children and roughly 3 million teachers, numbers that do not include the many other personnel affiliated with schools, from custodians to bus drivers to food service providers, or the many children in preschool and daycare programs and their 2 million caregivers. Early in the coronavirus pandemic, I was asked to provide advice regarding school closures to one large southern state and to the principals of several schools around the country. All those school leaders were struggling mightily with a very difficult decision to close schools. The smooth operation of schools, with children playing in the playground, the rounds of the school buses, and the morning rituals of countless working families, packing lunches and sending their children off for the day so that they themselves may go to work, is very hard to abandon. Many millions of children in the United States rely on schools not only for lunch, but also breakfast and sometimes dinner. These children come from environments in which the safest place for them is actually the school, an argument that was also made explicitly in 1918 in New York City. Closing schools can harm children who are neglected or unsafe at home and who benefit from the caring eyes of a teacher. Moreover, healthcare workers and first responders are needed in a crisis. Closing schools may mean they are not available to help in the epidemic because they are stuck at home watching their own children. Despite some objections, schools did close across the nation. The total closure of schools and the pivot to remote learning was a momentous event that most Americans had never experienced before, and families around the country reacted with varying degrees of incredulity, distress, relief, and resignation. Teachers and parents alike found the transition to remote learning difficult, or in some cases, impossible. The nation's patchy infrastructure left some teachers conducting video conferences from their cars, and plenty of families had neither internet nor laptops. Videos of baffled and overtaxed parents quickly went viral, including one of an Israeli woman losing her cool, to put it mildly, at the prospect of homeschooling multiple children while holding down a job. Others coped, once again, with gallows humor. One photograph of a liquor store billboard that read, "Homeschooling? Get your supplies here," went viral. The school shutdowns laid bare many life-work balance realities that were present before the shutdown, including the differential impact on men versus women and on the rich versus the poor. Once again, the pandemic highlighted and amplified long-standing societal challenges. So was shutting schools down the right thing to do? Most of the research for other respiratory infections supports the claim that school closures soften the force of the epidemic, postponing the peak and reducing the case count. This is likely true in the case of the COVID-19 pandemic too, though the evidence that is emerging is mixed and it is very difficult to be sure. An even more difficult issue relates to the usual utilitarian calculus of public health, whether the lives saved by closing the schools are, in fact, worth the short-term and long-term cost to children and to society. Complicating matters, there is an admittedly small percentage of families and children for whom the school closures in the spring of 2020 appear to have been beneficial, or at least not harmful, from an educational or socioeconomic point of view. This group includes children with supportive, stimulating home environments, some of whom have a non-working parent or grandparent available during the daytime, and older students of all backgrounds who have experienced anxiety, fatigue, bullying, or burnout from traditional school schedules and programming, and manage quite well on their own time. The obstacles to safely reopening schools that were shuttered during the spring of 2020 also seemed insurmountable in many communities, and they included, to name but a few, the shockingly decrepit physical condition of school facilities, which put occupants at risk for respiratory illnesses, a lack of funding to implement new protocols necessary to meet recommended public health guidelines, and the need to adapt curriculum and teaching practices to account for the much wider range of learning outcomes and psychological needs children would likely present when they did return to school. School districts all over the country also wrestled with how to balance appropriate public health measures in a mixed-age population of adults and children with equally important objectives to promote health and well-being, such as a kindergartner's need to see her teacher's face, a 10th grader's need for extracurricular activities, or older teachers' need to avoid contracting the infection. By July 2020, with cases rising sharply around the nation, polls showed that 71% of American parents thought it was risky to reopen schools. While there is much we still do not know about the long-term impact of the 2020 school closures on our society, I think it's fair to assume that there will be many unforeseen and primarily, but not exclusively, negative consequences. Here, however, I want to focus not so much on the issue of whether the costs of school closure are worth it in economic or social terms, but rather on how school closures work to stem an epidemic in the first place, the types of school closures societies adopt, and why they are considered the penultimate step, just short of stay-at-home orders, in the range of non-pharmaceutical interventions at a society's disposal. There are two types of school closures. The first is reactive closure, which is closing a school or all the schools in a district when a case or cases has been diagnosed at the school. This is relatively uncontroversial, and almost everyone, teachers, parents, politicians, clamors for this when a case is discovered in a school. Detailed models show that if school closure is reactive, in the case of a moderately transmissible virus, the cumulative cases of the condition might decline 26% and the epidemic peak could be delayed by 16 days. But reactive school closure, while rational and often helpful, is not enough. In my view, if decision makers are prepared to close schools at all, they should be closed before the first case in a school, when disease cases begin to appear in the community or in nearby areas. This is called proactive closure, and it's more controversial. Rigorous analyses show that proactive closure is one of the most beneficial interventions that can be employed to reduce the impact of epidemic disease. But if a school is prepared to close in a reactive fashion once there is an outbreak in the school, why not close a little earlier in a proactive fashion and get more of the benefit? If there is community transmission of a germ near the school, it's a certainty that it will be in the school before long. Hence, closing the school proactively, 1 or 2 weeks before one might have closed it in a reactive fashion, offers substantial advantages. Waiting to implement reactive closure places all of the same burdens on schools and parents, but offers fewer of the benefits with respect to epidemic control. It can be hard to estimate the benefits of school closures precisely. Closures are clearly more beneficial in outbreaks where the children themselves are substantially affected by the disease, as in the case of polio. Still, it's important to note that the primary purpose of school closure is to reduce social mixing, not necessarily to protect children from infection. By radically decreasing social interactions in a community, closing schools can have a powerful effect, even if, as in the case of SARS-2, children are relatively spared becoming sick. In part, it works by keeping the kids from acting as vectors, which they can indeed be with SARS-2, and in part it works by forcing parents to stay home. When epidemiologists develop models to assess the impact of school closures, they sometimes include a parameter that captures what fraction of the parents in a community must stay home as a result. In principle, adults could, of course, be encouraged or even ordered to stay home while their children still attended school. In reality, this does not happen because stopping work is economically devastating and, I believe, because we tend to put less emphasis on the needs of children compared to adults. In American schools, the millions of children and adults are in far closer daily physical proximity and for longer duration, 35 or more hours per week, than are adults in most workplaces. The impact of banning occasional large gatherings like sporting events or religious services does not even come close to that of school closure. Because of this, school closures are the most consequential NPI that can be employed, short of requiring everyone to stay home. One inventive study examined the impact of school closures and other NPIs and their precise timing during the 1918 influenza pandemic. It looked at 43 major U.S. cities and concluded that the earlier that the schools were closed, ideally in advance of outbreaks, the lower the number of excess deaths. Moreover, the longer that school closures and other non-pharmaceutical interventions, such as bans on gatherings, were maintained, the lower the ultimate mortality rate. As shown in Figure 14 of your PDF, St. Louis closed its schools before local cases had already doubled and kept them closed for longer, 143 days, than Pittsburgh, 53 days. By the end of the pandemic, St. Louis had less than half the excess deaths that Pittsburgh had, 358 out of 100,000 people, compared to 807 out of 100,000. Of course, there could have been other pertinent differences between these cities, and such observational studies are limited. But we cannot randomly assign whole cities to different sorts of NPIs in order to do a true experiment, so we must take what data we can. In 2020, we can see several different approaches to school closings around the world. Japan closed all the schools in the entire nation at the end of February 2020 and planned to keep them closed through April. The Japanese had learned from prior outbreaks, including the H1N1 outbreak in 2009. By contrast, Singapore did not use school closures and instead successfully implemented a rigorous and elaborate procedure of temperature checks and hand washing at their schools. Italy closed schools nationwide in a reactive fashion in early March, far too late to blunt the force of the epidemic. In the United States, the CDC guidance was still very gentle and avoided recommending closure as late as March 5, 2020. But by early March, at least 46,000 schools had closed, or were scheduled to close, or had closed briefly and reopened, affecting at least 21 million children out of the 55.6 million K-12 students in the United States. By the end of the school year, 55.1 million students in over 124,000 schools had their schools closed. Americans would struggle with the decisions about whether schools should reconvene for in-person classes in the fall of 2020. Yet if officials are unable or unwilling to keep schools closed, they have other choices to at least reduce physical contact. First, not every family will be comfortable sending their child to school during an outbreak. In some school districts in hot zones, like New York City in March 2020, many parents were already keeping their children home before school closures were announced. Allowing these families to make this choice decreases transmission to others and can even be seen as a public service. Schools are ordinarily concerned about truancy, especially for at-risk students such as homeless children, but such rules might beneficially be suspended, or schools can offer some form of optional remote instruction to families who need it. Teachers and administrators can also implement other practical measures to minimize risk. An important adaptation would be to give children of all ages much more outdoor time or hold classes outside, since disease transmission is so much less likely outdoors than indoors. Many early childhood teachers have discovered the myriad benefits of outdoor learning, so this could be helpful to children in other ways. Still other measures, such as increased custodial cleanings, temperature checks, and more frequent hand washing, will be time-consuming and expensive, but should be implemented as much as possible. Anyone who has actually observed children will know that teachers need to provide a high level of surveillance around personal hygiene, even for older children. Increasing physical distance between students is a challenge in overcrowded schools, where instruction sometimes takes place in hallways, but it's important. Canceling gym classes and band practices and prohibiting mixing in common areas are obvious, if regrettable, measures. Schools could also limit outside visitors, field trips, and non-essential social events. Changes in schedules and hybrid models of in-person and remote learning can help. But a school with such extensive constraints is not a school as we ordinarily understand the term. These are tough dilemmas. To understand the challenges of implementing NPI strategies in the midst of a pandemic and the dangers imposed by the failure to do so, let's consider New York City's 2020 response in depth. Amazingly, for such a sophisticated city with a storied public health department and with a history of mostly successful actions in 1918, New York City stumbled in its response to the pandemic, lagging behind other cities in implementing physical distancing measures and paying the price in sick and dead patients. Of course, it's difficult to be sure whether any sort of intervention, unless implausibly early and extreme, truly could have stopped the epidemic in an enormous, heterogeneous, and densely packed transportation hub like New York City. But moving more quickly would surely have saved lives during the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Tom Frieden, the former head of the CDC, would later estimate that if New York had adopted widespread physical distancing measures even a week or two earlier, the death toll might have been reduced by 50% to 80%. Based on an analysis of national and international travel patterns alone, it's very likely that the virus was already on the loose in New York City by mid-February 2020 at the latest. Genetic analyses show this to be the case. Phylogenetic analysis of 84 distinct genomes of SARS-2 specimens collected in the city through March 18th confirmed that there were multiple independent introductions of the virus to the city, primarily from Europe, Italy in particular, but also from other parts of the United States. If I had to guess, I would say that the virus arrived in the city in January. The first confirmed case of COVID-19 in New York City was not diagnosed until March 1st. The patient was a 39-year-old woman, a healthcare worker and resident of Manhattan, who had just returned from Iran. By that point in time, just 32 people had been tested for COVID in the state of New York, but a model based on travel patterns estimated that there may have already been over 10,000 infected people in the state. The day after this first known case was announced, the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, appeared with the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, to say that contact tracers would look for every person on the woman's flight. It was later revealed that this did not happen because it was the CDC's job to do that, and they did not prioritize it. This was an inauspicious opening act for the known part of the outbreak in New York. Events would move more rapidly over the next 4 weeks, in keeping with the exponential growth of epidemics. In his statement about this first case, Governor Cuomo sought to prevent panic, saying, "There is no reason for undue anxiety. The general risk remains low in New York. We are diligently managing the situation and will continue to provide information as it becomes available." While the desire to avoid panic is commendable, though I had seen no evidence of New Yorkers panicking, such false reassurance was misguided given what we knew about the impact of the virus in China and Europe. 2 days later, on March 3rd, New York City confirmed its second case of COVID-19 in a 50-year-old lawyer named Lawrence Garbuz, who had no recent travel history and who had been ill since the middle of February. Garbuz went to the emergency department with a fever on February 27, 2020, quickly lapsed into a coma, and woke up 3 weeks later. This was the first case of community transmission to come to light in the city. It was a sign that the virus was on the loose. Officials just happened to observe the tip of the iceberg. Garbuz lived in the suburb of New Rochelle and worked in Midtown Manhattan. In the wake of the discovery of this case, multiple institutions, ranging from a synagogue to Garbuz's daughter's school, were shut down, and many people, including healthcare workers who had initially cared for him, would be quarantined. To help prevent the further spread of infection, the National Guard was mobilized. On March 10th, the governor announced a one-mile radius containment area centered in New Rochelle that would be in place from March 12th to March 25th. The National Guardsmen cleaned schools and delivered food to quarantine individuals, but they also established a zone where all schools, places of worship, and large gathering facilities were closed and gatherings were banned. Still, this was hardly a Wuhan-level quarantine. People were free to move about and go into Manhattan for work, for instance. By March 6th, there were 22 more known cases in New York City. Of the 44 total cases in the state at that time, 29 were suspected to be linked to Garbuz. The city pleaded for more tests from the federal government as the case count rose. Fewer than 100 people had been tested on that date, and city officials notified the federal government that a shortage of tests had impeded our ability to beat back this epidemic. Testing in New York City had been severely limited since February due to the broader national limitations we discussed earlier. Infectious disease experts in the city had been informed, on a call on February 7th, that the federal criteria would restrict testing to patients with a fever severe enough to require hospitalization and with a history of travel to China in the preceding 14 days. It was at that moment that I think everybody in the room realized we're dead, one doctor would later recall. Contact tracing would simply be impossible due to the lack of testing and very limited manpower to follow up on results. New York City had 50 contact tracers at that time. By comparison, Wuhan had 9,000. New Yorkers, the New York Times reported, began to feel anxious. That sentiment reverberates along the subways and sidewalks of New York City, where the usual throngs and random interactions with strangers, the very things built into the magic and texture of this city, are approached with an unsettling caution in the age of the new coronavirus. Perhaps to promote feelings of normalcy, as of March 5th, Mayor de Blasio was still encouraging subway travel, and a photo showed him grinning in a packed subway car. "I'm here on the subway to say to people, nothing to fear, go about your lives, and we will tell you if you have to change your habits. But that's not now," he said. In my view, this was supremely irresponsible. On March 9th, deliberations about whether to close the schools proactively were still ongoing. But some schools began to have to close reactively. The New York prep school Horace Mann closed after notifying parents that one of its students was being tested for coronavirus. Experts were worried and continued to attempt to sound the alarm. 36 New York City infectious disease doctors strongly endorsed closing New York City schools in a public letter to the mayor dated March 12, 2020. But de Blasio planned to keep schools open, he announced on March 13th. "We are doing our damnedest to keep schools open," he said. De Blasio was concerned that poor families would have nowhere for their kids to go, just as officials were in 1918. "If you suddenly in one day close down the schools, how do you make sure that you are providing for these kids and their parents?" one of his aides later said. "We're not the suburbs. We can't tell people to stay at home and play around in your yard." But another of de Blasio's advisors, Dimitri Daskalakis, the head of disease control for the city, threatened to quit if the schools were not closed. Public school teachers were also in rebellion. School closure was inevitable, so it is unclear what the delay achieved. De Blasio relented 2 days later, on March 15th, and finally closed the schools. Plans were made to provide childcare to healthcare workers and first responders. At the time, the city had 329 confirmed COVID-19 cases. In comparison, San Francisco had closed the schools 3 days earlier, when it had only 18 confirmed cases. Decision-making was difficult during this period in March. Developments were fast-paced, and leaders were in reactive mode. On March 11th, after much outcry from public health experts, including myself, the St. Patrick's Day Parade, which draws about 150,000 marchers and 2 million spectators, was prudently canceled for the first time in 250 years, and New York thereby avoided making the mistake that Philadelphia made in 1918. On March 12th, both Governor Cuomo for the state and Mayor de Blasio for the city declared a state of emergency and banned large gatherings. On March 17th, theaters, concert venues, nightclubs, and restaurants were closed. Finally, on March 20th, the governor issued a shelter-in-place order, effective March 22nd, closing down all non-essential businesses and basically compelling New Yorkers to stay at home as much as possible. By that point, New York had 8,452 cases. While the state had 6% of the U.S. population, it had roughly half of all known cases. By comparison, the state of California had gone to this level of physical distancing on March 19th, just a few days before, when it had 1,009 cases. The governor's order stated that all non-essential businesses statewide will be closed. Non-essential gatherings of individuals of any size for any reason, e.g. parties, celebrations, or other social events, are canceled or postponed at this time. Any concentration of individuals outside their home must be limited to workers providing essential services, and social distancing should be practiced. When in public, individuals must practice social distancing of at least 6 feet from others. Businesses and entities that provide other essential services must implement rules that help facilitate social distancing of at least 6 feet. Sick individuals should not leave their home unless to receive medical care and only after a telehealth visit to determine if leaving the home is in the best interests of their health. The streets of New York City became eerily deserted. Later, Cuomo would extend his order through the end of April. Some New Yorkers ignored the rules, of course, crowding public spaces, since sheltering at home in New York City's small living spaces was a hardship for many. But it was too late. By March 22nd, New York City had become the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, accounting for approximately 5% of the world's confirmed cases at the time. At the outset of the epidemic, both the mayor and the governor had put a lot of stock in New York's large and sophisticated healthcare system, reasoning that surely it could cope with a crisis. Hospital executives also expressed confidence. But on March 18th, Mayor de Blasio reported that more than 1,000 retired medical workers in the city had answered his appeal the prior day to volunteer to help, as had occurred in Italy. Emergency departments and intensive care units teamed with redeployed dermatologists, ophthalmologists, and neurologists. Hospitals began to report apocalyptic conditions by March 25th. And on March 27th, similar to what had happened in Wuhan, the Army Corps of Engineers deployed to New York City to convert the 1,800,000-square-foot Jacob Javits Convention Center into a 2,910-bed civilian hospital. The city pleaded with federal authorities to nationalize the production of PPE and ventilators, which were rapidly running out. The mayor estimated that they had only 10 days of supplies left. In a resigned statement, the governor noted that 40%, up to 80% of the population will wind up getting this virus. All we're trying to do is slow the spread, but it will spread. As of that date, the city had 1,800 patients hospitalized, with 450 of them in ICUs, and just 99 deaths. This was quite a change in tone and substance from Governor Cuomo's comments just 3 weeks earlier, which is what happens in bad epidemics that move fast. In the span of 3 weeks since his subway ride, Mayor de Blasio also changed his tune. He now warned, "The worst is yet to come. April is going to be a lot worse than March, and I fear May could be worse than April." In early April, China and Oregon sent ventilators to New York City. The mayor urged anybody in the city with a ventilator, including veterinarians, to step forward, saying, "We could use every single one of them." Indeed, by April 21st, given the overload of COVID-19 patients, New York State issued drastic new guidelines urging EMTs not to bother trying to revive people without a pulse when they got to a scene. "They're not giving people a second chance to live anymore," observed the head of the city union representing paramedics. "Our job is to bring patients back to life. This guideline takes that away from us." The healthcare system strained under the load, and very worrisome reports reached me from my medical friends in the city. They described the situation as gruesome and unreal, with the incessant arrival of very sick patients and the ICUs bursting. "It was like a refugee camp in a war zone," one nurse observed. Working conditions were extremely difficult, requiring providers to be in layers of protective equipment. They were uncomfortable, but they also feared the imminent unavailability of PPE. Doctors and nurses improvised equipment from office supplies or brought PPE in from home. Hospital morgues filled up. On March 25th, some 85 refrigerated trailers were sent by FEMA to provide places for the bodies. Rules were relaxed so that local crematories could work around the clock. Some healthcare personnel began to get sick, and many died, poignantly after being admitted to their own hospitals. Photographs emerged of exhausted healthcare workers in what looked like white spacesuits resting outside hospitals, getting a bit of sun before returning to battle. In some photos, their faces were blistered and bruised from wearing tight-fitting masks all day. The photos reminded me of the famous photo of firefighters collapsed and asleep not far from a forest fire that still raged. And the situation also reminded me of the SARS-1 epidemic in the hospitals in Asian capitals years before. I have cared for patients in elite hospitals with plentiful supplies in every bedside cart, and I have been a citizen of this rich nation since I was born, and I could not believe these events. Our nation spends 17.7% of its GDP on healthcare, and this was our level of preparedness? Initially, the virus struck New York City in a seemingly even-handed way, claiming the lives of both mass transit workers and celebrities. But soon, of course, the burden was higher on the less privileged. Working-class immigrant communities, such as those in central Queens, were especially hard hit. The adjoining neighborhoods of Corona, Elmhurst, East Elmhurst, and Jackson Heights emerged as an epicenter within an epicenter. With a combined population of 600,000 people, these neighborhoods had 7,260 coronavirus cases on April 8th, whereas Manhattan as a whole, with three times the population, had 10,860 cases. As with past plagues, those able to do so fled the city. An analysis of cell phone records for a large sample of New Yorkers during the month of March showed that, while the city's population decreased by only about 4-5% overall, the population declined more than 50% in some of the richest neighborhoods. People began to leave in early March, before the NPIs were officially implemented. While most of the richest residents fled to nearby places in upstate New York and Connecticut, many others were tracked to Arizona, Michigan, and Southern California. On March 31st, Governor Cuomo observed, "I am tired of being behind this virus. We've been playing catch-up. You don't win by playing catch-up." And he was right. As he spoke, there were 76,946 cases in the state. By April 6th, there were 72,181 confirmed cases and at least 2,475 deaths in New York City alone, and the city had 25% of the COVID-19 deaths in the United States. The statewide shelter-at-home order was extended through April 29th. Finally, on April 15th, the pandemic peaked in New York's hospitals, a result of the NPIs that had been implemented 3 weeks earlier. On schedule, given the epidemiology of how COVID-19 spreads and the timing of clinical progression of the disease, with up to 2 weeks for a patient to feel symptoms and a further week to fall critically ill. By the end of April, the curve had been flattened. But the result of the outbreak was staggering. A statewide antibody testing survey found that 21.2% of the city's residents had contracted COVID-19 in the first wave. And analyses revealed that travel from New York City had seeded a wave of outbreaks of coronavirus throughout the rest of the United States. While NPI strategies did eventually work in New York City, there are still many unknowns about how the city's responses might have yielded a more or less devastating outcome. One of the greatest mysteries of pandemics is why some regions are stricken and others are spared. In the 1957 flu pandemic, as we noted in Chapter 2, there was an enormous range in the number of cases and deaths from place to place. And the same was observed in the United States and around the world in 2020 with COVID-19. No doubt when the dust settles, colored maps of countries in the world will show hot spots where the burden of death was particularly severe. Some of this variation will have to do with different policies implemented by various governments at the national and local level. Some of it will have to do with the vagaries of the number of imported cases that start the local epidemics, as we saw in both China and the United States. Some of it will have to do with environmental conditions or demographic profiles. Some might even relate to genetic differences in the strain of the virus that strikes a particular area. A very tiny amount might possibly have to do with genetic variations in humans from place to place. Some populations might happen to have genetic resistance. But most of the variation will just be due to chance, like that seen in photographs after a tornado where many houses are blown apart right next to a few that unaccountably are left standing. In the first few months of the pandemic, many experts tried to discern why some countries did better than others. What did China do and how did it do it? How did South Korea and Taiwan manage to contain the pandemic? As rich democracies, could the latter two be models for other European countries or for the United States? Every day, people would follow the graphs showing a kind of leaderboard, country by country, often in different colors, indicating the upward trajectory of the pandemic. The Asian countries, China, South Korea, Japan, Singapore, and Taiwan, veered off in long and low plateaus. But what struck me was not so much how to account for these differences that were possibly related to the timing and nature of the NPIs adopted or to other features of these societies, but rather how the trajectories were so similar in all the countries before the interventions were implemented. At the outset, the virus just killed us, and it was mostly unaffected by the political system, religion, healthcare system, media environment, and myriad other attributes of our societies. After all, we are human, and the virus really does not care about the details. The upward trajectory as the pandemic initially took root in each nation was grimly similar. Furthermore, people themselves knew what to do, notwithstanding the failures or successes of their country's responses. People began to physically distance before being told or ordered to do so. For example, analyses of foot traffic in stores and bookings at restaurants around the world revealed that those began to decline a couple of weeks before collective NPI policies were implemented. The synchrony of the decline in restaurant bookings in OECD nations, seen on the online app OpenTable, was noteworthy. Each country had different distancing policies, different laws and cultures, and different rates of COVID-19. But restaurant bookings all fell to zero over the course of 15 days as the epidemic struck. Parents also began to withdraw their children from school before official closings were announced. By the time the New York City public schools were shuttered, as we saw earlier, a substantial percentage of children were already staying home. Thus, it did not matter what people did or who people were until they collectively responded by separating from one another and physically distancing. This raises the possibility that what is required to deflect the trajectory is simply achieving some overall level of response. No matter the specific combination of non-pharmaceutical interventions, as long as a certain threshold is reached, the pandemic can be brought to heel. This physical distancing and economic collapse, this slowing down, are all features of plagues. Priest and historian John of Ephesus noted as much during the plague of Justinian over 1,500 years ago. And in all ways, everything was brought to naught, was destroyed, and turned into sorrow. And buying and selling ceased, and the shops with all their worldly riches beyond description, and moneylenders' large shops closed. The entire city then came to a standstill as if it had perished. Thus, everything ceased and stopped. Such accounts of the effects of serious epidemic disease are eerily familiar. An economy involves exchanges, and these depend on social interactions. It's hard to have an economy or a functioning society if people are unable to interact. Plagues are a time of loss, not just of lives, but of livelihoods, and of routines, connections, liberty, and much else. Chapter 4. Grief, Fear, and Lies. The plague was nothing. Fear of the plague was much more formidable. Henri Poincaré, French Geodesy, 1900. Wanda DeSalle, a 76-year-old nurse from Madera, California, had no family members by her side when she died of coronavirus on March 30, 2020. Her daughter, Marina Silva, had said goodbye to her via FaceTime a few days earlier, asking her to blink if she could hear. DeSalle had contracted the virus 3 weeks before when she attended a funeral of a young colleague in the medical practice where she had worked for 40 years. At least 14 others contracted the disease from that same funeral in a super-spreading event. DeSalle subsequently transmitted the virus to her daughter, who fell ill caring for her, and who then passed it along to her own daughter. Both the daughter and the granddaughter recovered in time to attend DeSalle's funeral. But it was a funeral few could have imagined only a few weeks before, a drive-by burial during which the grieving family and a handful of friends sat in their separate cars at an 80-foot distance from the casket, which was lowered into the ground by four funeral home staff in masks and white gloves. The members of the close-knit, ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, are deeply immersed in shared daily rituals and face-to-face interactions, so the high mortality rate from COVID-19 and the physical distancing it imposed was a particularly harsh blow. One rabbi organized a special hotline to play ancient Jewish prayers for the dying on a speakerphone placed next to isolated ICU patients' bedsides. "My fellow Jew," a voice said reassuringly, "your family very much wants to be with you in person. However, due to the current circumstances, it just isn't safe or allowed." And then the rabbi recited Psalm 91:10. "No harm will befall you, nor will a plague fall upon your tent, for he will command his angels on your behalf to guard you in all your ways." The Talmud calls this passage the Song of Plagues. One interpretation states that Moses himself composed it while ascending into a cloud hovering over Mount Sinai, reciting these words as protection from the angels of destruction. It is hard for me to describe how hard my fellow hospice doctors and I would work, when I was still seeing patients, to keep people from dying alone. We took pains to arrange for families to have a warning about impending death, so that they could be there when the patient died, for their sake and the patient's sake. We honed our prognostic skills to help with this objective, which we regarded as essential. In fact, I wrote 2 books about prognosis, because it is so central to ensuring patients a good death. If patients had to die without their loved ones, we doctors often sat at the bedsides ourselves and held their hands. I did this many times, watching the particular kind of waxing and waning breathing pattern patients often showed near the end of life, known as Cheyne-Stokes respiration, and dreading the awful soft sound of the death rattle that sometimes happened as the patient finally stopped breathing. I had the sense, more than once, that the patient's hand had gotten strangely softer just before he or she died. I cannot explain it. Maybe it marked a surrender. On other occasions, we hospice doctors would engineer intricate ways to get patients discharged from the hospital, circumventing bureaucratic obstacles, and figuring out how to administer medications in non-intravenous ways – so that the patients might die at home among their loved ones. And so given the norms I had internalized, the many accounts I read of families prohibited from visiting their loved ones during the early days of COVID-19 in order to reduce the spread of infection or to conserve personal protective equipment struck me as not just inhumane, but immoral. But as with every other serious epidemic, many people died alone in 2020. Families were deprived of the chance to say goodbye or properly grieve. In one study I had done with some colleagues published in 2000, we documented that 81% of patients and 95% of family members felt that the presence of family when the patient died was very important. The lower percentage among patients may reflect their concerns for burdening their families. But the U.S. healthcare system was unable to honor these desires during the pandemic. As a physician, I hated having to call a family to say that their loved one had died. I remember one call in particular that I had to make when I was a resident physician at the University of Pennsylvania in 1990. My patient's spouse simply could not understand what I was calling to say. It was as if my words were in a foreign language. During the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic in New York City, another doctor explained how he had tried to comfort the husband of a dead patient over the phone. He was having a really hard time. He was an older man, he was at home alone, and he didn't have any family with him. The doctor said that the encounter reminded him of prior experiences in Africa. "This happened with Ebola. The family is kept away. There are no funerals. This feels like that." Serious pandemics are a time of grief. When the death rate of a plague is particularly high, the situation is devastating. Here is an account by Petrarch of the Black Death. "What are we to do now, brother? Now that we have lost almost everything and found no rest, when can we expect it? Where shall we look for it? Time, as they say, has slipped through our fingers. Our former hopes are buried with our friends. The year 1348 left us lonely and bereft, for it took from us wealth that could not be restored by the Indian, Caspian, or Carpathian Sea. Last losses are beyond recovery, and death's wound beyond cure." Thankfully, COVID-19 is not remotely as bad as the bubonic plague, but deadly epidemics always spawn parallel epidemics of a psychological or existential nature, less tangible, but equally virulent. Grief, anger, fear, denial, despair, and even anomie are not unexpected emotional reactions to the personal and collective loss in a serious outbreak of infectious disease. It can sometimes be hard to get a deep feeling for this suffering, either because people living through a pandemic are hunkered down trying to avoid their own calamities, or because of the sheer scale of the losses. The old saying about the indifference that can arise in the face of mass mortality comes to mind. One death is a tragedy, a million deaths a statistic, a variant of which is usually attributed to Stalin. Author Laura Spinney, in her account of the 1918 flu pandemic, described the many millions of deaths that occurred from influenza, amplified by the massive casualties and dislocations of World War I, as the dark matter of the universe, so intimate and familiar as not to be spoken about. 100 years later, Americans have less experience with untimely death, and they are also less resigned to it. Many people live for decades without seeing death up close, while most Americans died at home a century ago, witnessed by all their loved ones. This is less common now. But even so, there seemed to me to be an unsettling acquiescence to the COVID-19 deaths of 2020. When the death count reached 100,000, coincidentally on Memorial Day, there was a brief spasm of collective mourning. On May 24, 2020, the front page of the New York Times consisted entirely of names of the dead. But the news of the milestone was fairly quickly eclipsed by political scandals and dramatic protests. Many people did not really have a picture of the disease or of the process of dying from it. Was it painful, undignified, lonely? Of course, grief is not felt only for the lives lost, but also for the loss of our way of living. Adults lost their jobs or even their careers. People who were unable to pay their mortgages lost their homes. Scientists I know who had invested years in building scientific apparatuses had to abandon their research. Children were denied schooling, friendship, and outdoor play. Countless weddings and vacations were canceled, some permanently. Entrepreneurs lost their businesses. Online religious services, classes, counseling sessions, and Alcoholics Anonymous meetings were all pale replacements for the authentic connections humans evolved to crave but had to give up. In the new reality imposed by the pandemic, nearly everyone experienced some deprivation. Sometimes the losses were indeed permanent or serious. Lost lives, relationships, careers, or businesses. But even comparatively minor losses felt distressing, and they were widespread. We were not supposed to shake the hands of our neighbors or see them for dinner. We could not go out to restaurants, bars, coffee houses, nightclubs, salons, or gyms in the same way, if at all. Even small everyday occurrences could remind people of loss. I am not a clothes horse, but after just 3 months of lockdown, of wearing a t-shirt and jeans every single day, I would look into my closet, see my suits, and miss wearing them. I often complain that I have to do too much professional traveling, but one day in May, I spotted my luggage in the closet and had a wistful feeling. The damaging psychological impact of plague has been appreciated for a long time. In the 5th century BCE, regarding a plague in Athens of unknown etiology, possibilities range from typhus to Ebola, Greek general and historian Thucydides observed, "By far the most terrible feature in the malady was the dejection which ensued when anyone felt himself sickening, for the despair into which they instantly fell took away their power of resistance and left them a much easier prey to the disorder, besides which was the awful spectacle of men dying like sheep through having caught the infection in nursing each other." The Roman emperor and philosopher Marcus Aurelius noted in the 2nd century that what he called the corruption of the mind was much more dangerous during an epidemic than any such miasma and vitiation of the air which we breathe around us. In April 2020, one national survey conducted to gauge emotional wellness revealed areas of significant distress for a sizable percentage of the population. Comparing the responses to 2019 polling data, people felt worse on several axes in 2020. The percentage of people reporting feelings of enjoyment was 64%, compared to 83% in 2019. Worry, 52% versus 35%. Sadness, 32% versus 23%. And anger, 24% versus 15%, were all higher. Significant percentages of people in 2020 also reported boredom, 44%, and loneliness, 25%. People were worried about both the disease and its effects. For instance, another survey conducted at the end of April 2020 reported that 67% of Americans were somewhat concerned or very concerned about getting coronavirus themselves. But Americans were even more concerned that their family members would get the virus, with 79% expressing this fear. Another, more clinically focused study found that whereas in 2018, 3.9% of Americans had severe psychological distress, in April 2020, 13.6% did, placing them at serious risk for longer-term psychiatric problems. Americans' feelings during the pandemic differed according to variables such as household income and gender. Adults with annual household income of less than $36,000 were less likely to feel happy, 56%, and more likely to feel worried, 58%, bored, 49%, and lonely, 38%, compared to those earning more than $90,000, 75%, 48%, 39%, and 19% respectively. Women reported feeling about as happy as men, 71% versus 73%, but they were more worried, 51% versus 44%, and more lonely, 27% versus 20%. Over time, in another survey conducted after mitigation efforts to flatten the disease curve were well underway, Americans became slightly less fearful of contracting the coronavirus. 57% were worried in April, compared to 51% in May. But they became slightly more concerned about severe financial hardship, 48% in April, compared with 53% in May. Despite these anxieties, however, Americans generally understood that the virus had to be controlled before things could return to the way they had been. Overall, at least two-thirds of Americans rated as very important the following conditions for resuming normal everyday activities at that time. 1. Mandatory quarantine for anyone testing positive for coronavirus. 2. Improved medical therapies to prevent or treat COVID-19. And 3. Significant reduction in the number of new cases or deaths. In addition to grief, epidemics also bring fear. Fear can itself be contagious, forming a kind of parallel epidemic. Contagions of germs, emotions, and behaviors can act independently, or they can intersect. And fear has an advantage over even the most contagious pathogens. People can contract a disease only through contact with other infected individuals. But they can contract fear through contact with either infected individuals or fearful ones. We respond to the fear brought on by epidemics in various ways, many of which are directed at asserting control over the threat. For example, people have a tendency to blame others for the disease, which makes them feel they have some influence over the force that is affecting them. It is more soothing to feel that there is a human agent responsible for the problem, because this means human effort might be effective in response. It's more frightening to imagine that the plague originates from a vengeful, implacable God or from an uncaring and remorseless natural world. This desire for a sense of control can be destructive, especially since the objects of people's blame are often minority groups or those seen as outsiders. To mitigate this, an important challenge for public health authorities and leaders during a pandemic is to acknowledge widespread negative emotions and feelings of powerlessness and to help people effectively respond to them in constructive ways by offering outlets for their emotions. This is one of the reasons it makes sense for public health authorities to encourage the use of masks, and it's also why people can find mask wearing beneficial. It gives them something concrete to do in the face of the threat, regardless of the exact benefits of masks, which are considerable. This helps restore their sense of control. Another example is the act of collective public cheering for healthcare workers seen in New York City and London, which also gives people a sense of control and social solidarity. This psychological benefit is important in itself, and such acts may in turn foster a willingness to engage in more burdensome, difficult, and challenging practices. Getting fear and anxiety under control is critical. But it is easier said than done. Sometimes the lengths people go to displace fear, restore a sense of control, and assign blame can be quite baroque. During the 1916 outbreak of polio in the United States, the public faced a conundrum. The virus disproportionately struck young children in suburbs and more sparsely populated rural areas. How could this be squared with deeply entrenched stereotypes about urban immigrant tenement dwellers as vectors of disease? A New Jersey newspaper made a conceptual leap when it published a drawing of a giant horsefly seen menacing a helpless baby with this caption: "I am the baby killer. I come from garbage cans uncovered, from gutter pools and filth of streets, from stables and backyards neglected, slovenly homes, all manner of unclean places. I love to crawl on baby's bottles and baby lips. I love to wipe my poison feet on open food, in stores and markets patronized by fools." Creating an imaginary vector connected the sickness of innocent children to groups deemed worthy of blame, while also suggesting a way to avoid risk and restore a sense of control. A germ cannot be seen, but a fly can, and the actions required to deal with flies were positive and helped people feel more in control, use screens and swatters. The fly theory also helped to explain how the sickness could have appeared in clean suburban homes. The danger was transported from a risk source composed of outsiders. In reality, of course, polio primarily spreads by the ingestion of fecal material from an infected person, for instance, through contaminated water or food. As Anne Finger explains in her moving autobiographical and cultural history of the polio virus, the fly became a carrier not just of contagion, but of displaced emotions. Fear brought on by epidemics can even cause people to shun those trying to help control the disease. On March 30, 2020, emergency physician Richard Levitin reported for duty at New York's Bellevue Hospital. The New Hampshire resident, like other volunteers from around the country who answered Governor Andrew Cuomo's call, had rushed to relieve the overwhelmed ICU staff in the city's hospitals. Dr. Levitin had trained at Bellevue himself and was an expert in intubation, the thorny task of placing and managing the endotracheal tube in critically ill patients undergoing mechanical ventilation. "This pandemic is the airway challenge of the century," he said. "I'm an airway guy. I'm not going to sit this one out." Dr. Levitin was planning to stay in his brother's empty apartment, but he soon faced a vexing obstacle, one of New York's notoriously unwelcoming co-op boards, which refused him temporary residence on the basis that he would be working with infected patients. He noted that the building was a ghost town, and some portion of those remaining were likely already infected, whereas he had come to New York from a low-prevalence state. But it did not make a difference. Other stories emerged of travel nurses who do temporary stints in hospitals for a few weeks or months at a time, being evicted on short notice by landlords, sometimes with hostility and threats that their belongings would be thrown away. As a nurse in Hawaii cogently pointed out, however, "We are the same people who are going to take care of you if you wind up in the hospital, and if I'm sleeping in my car, I'm not functioning my best." Doctors and nurses are trained to maintain safety precautions for themselves and others, and they take extraordinary measures to keep others safe, both inside hospital walls and beyond. In fact, as Dr. Atul Gawande observed, in the face of enormous risk, American hospitals have learned how to avoid becoming sites of spread. Out of a hospital staff of 75,000 in his Boston health system, there were so few workplace transmissions in the spring of 2020 that he argued hospitals should be providing a model of how to successfully reopen other sectors of the economy. But this did not stop a Florida judge from ordering temporary full-time custody of a 4-year-old to the ex-husband of an emergency medicine doctor, despite the doctor's argument that she was doing her utmost to keep her daughter safe and that, if she were still married, no one would have removed her child from her home. We clearly do not want healthcare workers sleeping in cars or losing their children, but people can act counterproductively from both an individual and collective point of view when in the grip of strong emotions. It is hard not to see these examples as anything but a product of an atmosphere of fear generated by an epidemic disease. Yet fearful people can also play a positive role if their fear paralyzes them to the point that they self-isolate indoors or put on a mask or take other actions helpful to themselves and the broader society. Such a response will, in general, reduce the impact of the epidemic by reducing the number of people in circulation. Frightened people are not exactly eager to mingle at the neighborhood bar. However, this benefit can be fickle. A premature recovery from fear may result in reintroducing previously fearful individuals into the population at an inopportune time, such as when an outbreak has not been sufficiently controlled, thus contributing to subsequent waves of the epidemic. To further complicate matters, if the fear results in individuals fleeing, which, as we have seen, is a common response to outbreaks, then this can add to the overall intensity of the epidemic, providing new seeds for outbreaks in previously unaffected areas. And fear that results in stigmatization or scapegoating, or that increases anxiety to the point where people cannot take in useful information, can also worsen the impact of the epidemic. An extraordinary example of the harm caused by an epidemic of fear occurred in India in 1994 with an outbreak of bubonic plague. Bubonic plague has been mostly conquered in India in the modern era, although it formed part of a deadly trinity of infections, along with cholera and smallpox, for much of India's history. Starting in early August 1994, after a typical sequence of increasing fleas and the observation of rat falls, a few cases of bubonic plague were diagnosed in the village of Mamla in the B district of the Maharashtra state. On September 14th, the government of India publicly announced that Bead was affected by plague. Within hours of this announcement, there was widespread panic. And on September 23, 1994, reports of pneumonic plague, the even deadlier variant, suddenly appeared in the industrial town of Surat in neighboring Gujarat state. Between September 21st and October 20th, 1,027 patients with serious pneumonia were admitted to hospitals in that city, and 146 of the cases were for some reason presumed to be pneumonic plague. Investigators were skeptical, however, because no cases of the bubonic plague or of outbreaks in the rat population had been noted in Gujarat, both of which